Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. Let's go to the show. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other public health threats. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
It was nice to see you last week at the first annual Dr. Swartzberg lecture at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. I thought we could pick up where it sounds like Teresa left off with you last week, which is on the newest subvariant of COVID. It's nicknamed Cicada. It is formerly named BA.3.2. Seems to account for a growing share of cases in the United States. And concerningly, is showing up in a disproportionately high proportion of samples from children who get their strain of COVID genetically sequenced. What do we make of what looks like higher pediatric infection rates?
Well, this whole thing with Cicada is really interesting. And at this point, not frightening. It was first identified in 2024 in South Africa. And there were some cases there. Cases didn't appear to be any different than other cases of COVID that we were seeing. That is, not more serious, not leading to more hospitalizations and deaths. But then it sort of went underground. It sort of went away. We didn't see it again for a good while. And then beginning last year, we started seeing cases in Europe sprouting up, and cases all over the planet sprouting up, including here in the United States and including here in California. It got this moniker, Cicada, because cicadas appear every X number of years. Typically, back east, I know about every 17 years. Sometimes it's 13 years. So these are phenomena that where they appear, and then they go away, and then they appear again. And that's where people give it this moniker of cicada. But its proper name is BA.3.2, which tells us that it's an Omicron virus. It's in that family of Omicron, but it's quite different than the others. It has between 70 and 75 amino acid changes all in their spike protein, all in its spike protein. And the spike protein is the part of the virus that attaches to our cells and allows it to get inside of our cells. So it's mutating considerably in that area. Typically, the mutated Omicron viruses will have maybe 30 to 40 amino acid changes. So it's changed much more than we typically have seen. And as you were mentioning, Brian, we have seen more and more cases of this. It's now up to, I think at last check that I did, it was around 11% of cases here in California. And most of those are occurring, most of those are occurring in children as opposed to adults. So that's what we know about it in terms of its epidemiology. But interesting, when you look at the number of people going to the emergency rooms with COVID now, you look at the people having to seek medical care at their doctor's office because they're so sick with COVID, or people being hospitalized with COVID and people dying with COVID, we're seeing very, very low levels, the lowest we've ever seen in the pandemic. We're seeing very few hospitalizations and very few deaths today. So there's been a lot talked about in terms of cicada, and for good reason. It's growing in terms of the percent of the infections being caused by it as opposed to the other types of Omicron. But it doesn't seem to be causing any more severe disease, and it doesn't seem to even be causing more disease, except perhaps in children. So that's what we know about it right now. What it's going to do tomorrow, nobody knows. But given the high degree of immunity that our population has because of vaccines or previous infections, it's really unlikely that this is going to explode. It co could cause a surge, or it could cause a mini surge, or it could cause nothing. So stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned. The thing I have been most worried about since there was widespread access to vaccines and Paxlovid was not acute illness, although it's still a serious problem for some people, but the likelihood of long COVID, some form of long-term impairment or disability resulting from an infection that might not seem that bad at first blush. Do we have any kind of picture into how the risks of long COVID are changing over time?
We do. And I really appreciate your pointing out long COVID. People talk about COVID. I talk about it. I tend to emphasize how sick people are going to get, whether they'll wind up in the hospital, whether they're going to be on a ventilator, whether they're going to die. And those, of course, are critical things. But often we tend to de-emphasize or not even mention long COVID. And this is a devastating problem for people. And it's not rare. So you're right. Always bring that up when we talk about COVID. Terribly important topic. In terms of what do we know about cicada causing long COVID, we really don't have much data at all to tell us, to really inform us as to whether this is going to be less common, more common, and so on. Now, we do have really good data over the last 3 years, really during the Omicron pandemic. It's almost like two viruses. There was the original Alpha and De Beta and Delta that were terribly virulent and spread like wildfire. And then Omicron that spread really like wildfire. And that's, we've been in the Omicron pandemic for a good while now. We're seeing in the last 2 or 3 years less long COVID from people getting infected than we were seeing in the first 3 years. Now, whether that means that the immunity you have from vaccines or from the virus, a previous infection, or whether it means a change in the virus itself to be causing less COVID, we can't really answer precisely. Although the emphasis or the data suggests pretty strongly that certainly, Omicron is playing a role in less long COVID. It doesn't appear to cause it as often. So that's good news. The bad news is that it still can, and it's a good reason. It remains a very good reason to avoid getting infected with this virus, if at all possible.
We should open up the phone lines at this point. If you'd like to put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg, it's 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your Corona calls. And I'll pluck a question on this topic from our inbox. John in Portola Valley wrote to follow up on your description of how cicada was originally detected some time ago in South Africa and now has cropped up here, and asks, is this because it definitely migrated from elsewhere, or is it possible that a new variant can independently emerge in different places?
What an interesting question. Either could happen. It's what we've seen with the COVID pandemic is that most of the time we've seen one new variant pop up that has such selective advantages. Usually it's more transmissibility for a variety of reasons that it spreads rapidly over the world. At the beginning of the pandemic, the original strain of SARS-CoV-2 that caused disease in China in December of 2019 and January of 2020, by the time it got to the United States, it was a new virus. It had turned into what we call Alpha. And much of that came from the from directly from China to the West Coast and then spread throughout the United States. But we also saw the virus come from China to Europe, mainly Italy initially, and then from Italy rest of Europe and the United States. And that was a little different than the alpha we saw. So what we can see is one virus popping up have such selective advantage that it just explodes around the world. We can see that virus, as it moves around the world, change enough to even have its own new name or numbers. And what we can say is that a virus could pop up in one part of the world, and the identical virus could pop up in another part of the world because it could do it, and it was effective. So all of those are possibilities, but the primary thing that we've seen is that a new virus arises somewhere on this planet, causes disease in human beings, is more transmissible, and spreads across the world.
It seems to me as a matter of math that it would be very simple for a single mutation to happen in parallel. If one particular change to one protein on the spike, one amino acid on the spike protein in the virus makes it slightly easier to infect people. You might see it emerge in different places simultaneously. But when you start talking about subvariants that are accreting dozens of mutations, like you said, somewhere around 75 amino acids change on the spike protein in cicada, it becomes much less likely that the same set of mutations are produced identically in different places in parallel.
That's right. Yeah, it just becomes a numbers game. And it's every change makes it less probable that another virus is making those identical changes.
All right. 1-800-958-9008 to put a question to Dr. Swartzberg. 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. Jerry writes in with a question about another disease that recently laid him up and is on the upswing right now at the tail end of influenza-like illness season, human metapneumovirus. When he got sick, he says, I was told that I was only contagious for as long as I had a fever, but I was also advised to wear a mask around others for 5 days regardless. Do you know more about this? Is there any kind of in-home test to find out if I'm in the clear?
There is an in-home test. Let me backtrack before we get to that. Human metapneumovirus has been around a long, long time, but we hadn't been able to identify it readily until the last few decades. So when I taught infectious disease to public health students and medical students, for half of my career, I never talked about metapneumovirus. It wasn't until the last 20 or maybe 30 years that we did talk about it. And the reason why it didn't reach a lot of prominence was that it didn't cause, it typically did not cause the serious disease we see with COVID and we see with influenza. It was a lesser respiratory tract infection for most people in terms of severity. More recently, though, we have tests that can detect this virus, and they're PCR tests, so they're very sensitive. They're done by a swab, just like with COVID and SARS. Excuse me, it's COVID and influenza. So we can detect it pretty readily. And since we've been able to do that, we've been able to diagnose it. And if somebody comes in and it looks like SARS or it looks like metapneumovirus or it looks like COVID or it looks like another two or three respiratory viruses, we can distinguish them now. And we tell people exactly what they have. Metapneumovirus tends to cause less severe disease than influenza and COVID. It occasionally can. It occasionally can cause a pneumonia, but it's unlikely to do that. So it's a cause of the common cold, that is red eyes, sniffles, maybe ears plugged, sore throat. It's the common cause of the common cold, plus some lower respiratory tract diseases like a lot of coughing, perhaps with some bronchitis. But it rarely goes into pneumonia, but it can, but it rarely does. So metapneumovirus is around. It's actually in, it's having its day right now, and it has been having its day for the last few months. So There's a lot of metapneumovirus causing respiratory tract infections. So if one of our listeners gets a cold, it's probably more likely right now to be metapneumovirus or another respiratory virus, of which there's several, or it could be a mild case of COVID or influenza. But since the latter two are on the wane and metapneumovirus is still around in considerable numbers, statistically speaking, it's perhaps more likely to be metapneumovirus or one of these other viruses.
So, reading into Qu Rick's question here, which is lengthy, I only read an excerpt from it. He's concerned about when it's safe to stop taking precautions to keep from passing human metapneumovirus to his wife. The advice he got was wait until 5 days after you have a fever, which sounds suspiciously identical to the advice around COVID. How well do we understand the window of infectiousness for human metapneumovirus versus just kind of borrow template public health advice from other respiratory infections?
Right. We don't know as much. That said, it probably is similar to influenza and COVID. And so we often see that advice given, and it's not unreasonable advice. The data we have on it tends to suggest that it's in highest concentrations in your secretion for probably the first day, 2 days, maybe going into 3 days, but then drops off pretty quickly. It would be nice if there was a readily available and inexpensive test to see if you still have the virus. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of it, anything other than a PCR test to do that. And the problem with the PCR test is that it's so sensitive, that is, it's so easy to detect it, that if the test is still positive, it doesn't necessarily mean you're still contagious because you're not secreting that many viral particles. So we need a test more like the home test, the chest for the antigen for metapneumovirus, but I don't believe that's. I haven't seen that available for the public. So,
Got it.
what to do? Let's get practical then. What to do is the advice that he was given is reasonable advice. If his symptoms are markedly improved, if he's had no fever for 24 hours, not taking anything to bring his fever down like aspirin or Tylenol, and he's feeling appreciably better, it's been 5 days since the initial illness or diagnosis. I think it's not unreasonable to come out of isolation at that point. One other thing to consider, though, is who might he infect who might not handle metapneumovirus as well as he did? That
Right.
is his wife immunocompromised, either by medication she's taking or by some other problem? In that case, you err on the side of dragging it out a few days, a few more days than just the 5 days. You want to be extra cautious. If you're going to be visiting people who might be immunocompromised or might be at increased risk of a bad result, stay away from those people and for a few days longer. That's probably the best advice.
All right, Dr. Swartzberg, we've got a bunch of callers waiting patiently on the line. Let's start here in the East Bay with Rick in Oakland. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call and thanks for the segment. I'm over 65 and I belong to Kaiser, and I contacted my doctor the other day to get a booster for COVID. I had the last one I got was about 6 months ago, and he said the new protocol is once a year. And I was very surprised by this. I believe I looked at the CDC and what they say, and they still say that you should get it every 6 months. So I wanted to know what the doctor thinks about this.
It's
Dr.
an
Swartzberg?
interesting, yeah, Rick, it's an interesting question. Kaiser is usually pretty good, quite good about following current recommendations. I think this time they may have dropped the ball. But it's not a black and white question. Let me explain. If you look at who winds up in the emergency room of adults, we'll just look at adults now. Who winds up in the emergency room? Who winds up getting hospitalized and who winds up dying? It's mostly people over 75. The next largest group of people who have bad outcomes are people over 65 and over. If you're healthy and under 65, the need for a booster at 6 months drops considerably in terms of the benefit you're going to get. So maybe Kaiser developed a protocol for 65 to 75. No, and 75 and above, yes. But I would check on that. I would check with somebody else at Kaiser because I think that most places are giving it without question for people 65 and over for the reasons I just expressed.
What do you recommend?
I would recommend if you were 65 and over, you should get a second vaccine in 1 year. So you get it every 6 months.
Okay, thank you.
Not a lot of downside to it. Thanks for the call, Rick. Let's stay in Oakland. We've got, looks like Micheline on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. The larger question is wondering if there is a way to think about any potential correlation between the long-term impact of other viruses like Epstein-Barr virus or HSV or COVID. And my more specific question is there a vaccine for people who have had Epstein-Barr virus in the past?
You mean a vaccine that would clear it from your system so that you don't get some of the things we're learning might result from Epstein-Barr, like multiple
Or, yeah, a
sclerosis?
long-term impact. I thought I heard something about it, but I doesn't it also doesn't make sense to me in a way that you would get a vaccine after the fact.
Yeah, Dr. Schwartzberg.
Well, that's Micheline's asking some really interesting questions, and that last point is interesting. Most vaccines don't work after the fact, but there are a few that do. But let's get directly to your question, and that is about other viruses causing long-term problems. And unfortunately, this is not rare at all. Since you focused on Epstein-Barr virus, let's focus on that for a moment. Most humans get infected with this virus before young adulthood, or at least adulthood. And if overall, roughly about 8 out of every 10 American adults are infected with this virus. Epstein virus is in the family of the herpes viruses. So once it infects you, it doesn't go away. It remains what we call latent. That is not apparently causing any problems, but it just remains in your body. You can't get rid of it. There's more and more evidence that chronic being infected with EBV can lead to other problems. There's compelling evidence that it can cause, in certain circumstances, serious malignancies, an unusual kind of lymphoma of the head and neck, primarily in Africa, an unusual kind of cancer, a different kind of cancer, in primarily, although not exclusively, in China. Called nasopharyngeal carcinoma. But the most, and those are terribly important because they're serious life-threatening diseases. The most interesting association that we're now seeing, although causality has not yet been proven, but highly suggested by experiments that have been done, is the association between having Epstein-Barr virus infection and developing multiple sclerosis. Now, 80% of the population is infected with Epstein-Barr virus, and 80% of the population, and nowhere near that, is getting multiple sclerosis. So there's clearly other factors playing a role here. But EBV as a cause, but not perhaps a sufficient cause alone to cause MS, multiple sclerosis, is a highly tenable hypothesis today. So it would be very good to have a vaccine. The ideal vaccine, as Micheline, you're referring to, would be a vaccine that you could give somebody, that it would prevent, it could either get rid of EBV in your body, Epstein-Barr virus in your body, or could suppress it so it couldn't perhaps cause these other problems. That's not available at this point, but there's certainly work on that. Long-term, developing a vaccine that is given to people before they are exposed, and that would allow them to never get EBV, and that could eliminate and would eliminate those two cancers I mentioned, plus the possibility of eliminating multiple sclerosis and perhaps other problems.
You could see the kind of population health benefits we've seen from vaccinating against HPV. Too late for most of us older people, but an incredible benefit to people who were young enough when that vaccine came out. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you for spending another Monday with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. And we ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. If you'd like to help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.